If you like to gamble, I tell you I'm your man. You win some, lose some, it's all the same to me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Motorcast. I am your host, Howard H. Smith. I am singer with UK thrash band Acid Rain, or you may know me from my podcast Talking Bollocks. My name is highlighted in the link to this podcast, and if you click on that, you will go straight through to the website and have access to hundreds of interviews that I've done with the great and the good of heavy metal over the years. But here, I am your custodian in this virtual museum we've created for the mighty Motorhead. Yes, welcome back. Thank you very much for listening. If this is your first time, please subscribe. If this is not your first time and you're already subscribed, please tell somebody else to subscribe. How you do that is wherever you're listening to this, however you're listening to this, there will be a way, there'll be a bell, there'll be a button, there'll be something you can click on that says, I'd like more of this, please. Click that, and every time we release an episode, it will appear in your device. It couldn't be more simple than that, could it? So, this week, today's guest is James Murphy. Yep, he has played guitar with all sorts of bands. He's played in Death on the classic Spiritual Healing era. He's played in Cancer. He's played in Obituary. He's played in Testament. And as we're going to be hearing, he also played as a young man in Agent Steel. He's a Motorhead fan. He's also somebody I've interviewed twice before for Talking Bollocks. So, full disclosure here, we have spoken before and I've got him on, and here he is having a chat with me all about his love of Motorhead. So, hello, James, welcome to the Motorcast.
Hello, hello. How's it going, Howard?
It's going very well, thank you, mate. It's going very well. Thank you very much for coming on. I'm going to start this the way I start every single episode, which is, how did Motorhead first come into your life?
Well, I was living in Germany and really just starting to get into, you know, heavy music and stuff. This prior to getting into, you know, heavier stuff. When I say heavier stuff, I mean, you know, what was heavy at the time, which is like Black Sabbath, Judas Priest, Rush, you know, Iron Maiden hadn't even kicked in yet, you know, AC/DC, things like that. I don't remember exactly which of the early albums sort of penetrated the, you know, into my world first. It was surely like either Iron Fist or Bomber, probably. And I remember very early on being impressed, you know, memories of that are really hazy because I was consuming so much music so fast that I really remember some of the first couple albums that I ever bought in heavy rock, heavy metal, which, like, the heavy rock ones were like Aerosmith, Toys in the Attic, and like Queen, News of the World, and of course Kiss. I probably remember getting my first Kiss album probably about 1975, but when Motorhead entered was a little bit later in the 70s. And then by the early 80s, I was well into them, you know. I remember having it always be a goal of mine, like when I was just dreaming of being a professional musician and touring. It was directly because of the No Sleep Till Hammersmith album that to me, the Hammersmith Odeon just seemed like this super iconic way. Oh man, if I ever get to play there, you know. Meanwhile, To the Locals is just kind of an old theater, you know, that they've gone to some iconic shows at. It's not a big deal. But for me, over in the States, you know, having never, you know, been to the UK at that point, although I did live in Germany, I wasn't too far away, because it was like featured in, you know, more than one album that I was aware of at the time, you know, and live albums. And of course, Motorhead's right there in the title, you know, No Sleep Till Hammersmith. So that album, you know, that was one of my favorite live albums. You know, I have an era from the mid-70s through into the early 80s that is the era for live albums for me. I don't really care for live albums these days, but that period, and No Sleep Till Hammersmith was one of them. And so that definitely penetrated, you know, deep into my consciousness, you know, to the point where I wanted to play the Hammersmith so bad. And then just a few years later, I did. You know, probably the fourth time that I, third or fourth time I had ever played live in front of people. The fourth time. It was the fourth time that I ever played live in front of people was Hell Hammersmith Odeon in 19 with the band Jim Steele. So that was a trip.
That's insane. Sorry, what was the name of the band?
Agent Steele.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Oh, right. I know the gig you're talking about then, because
Yeah,
that was
with
a.
Nuclear Assault, Atom Craft, and Onslaught.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that it wasn't it like a famously chaotic show?
It was pretty, probably, I mean, for me, I remember a little bit of chaos. A lot of it was behind the scenes. Some of it, I think, happened on stage. Like for me, like I had written a song with them during the rehearsals for the tour, and we basically got informed that we were going to play it live right before we left on the tour, so we knew we were playing it, going to be playing it. But I had to step on a particular patch to get this sort of big sound for the intro because it was me playing by myself, and I stepped on the wrong button, and I'm playing this really just pure clean guitar straight into power amp sound. It was like it was supposed to be like really heavy, and it was like dinky 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 dinky. It was awful. But yeah, so that was a little bit of chaos. But you know, there was most definitely chaos sort of behind the scenes, and I don't know how much of it crept out on stage. It was all a blur to me, Howard. I was 19, bro.
But I think it's just incredible that, like you say, having those dreams of playing Hammersmith Odeon, and then realizing that dream so quickly and so early in your career as well.
Yeah. I thought, oh, you know, maybe by the time I'm 30 or 35, I'll be, you know, I've progressed enough in a career, you know, and successful enough that I can play at the Hammersmith Odeon.
Yeah,
But
absolutely.
it turned out to be the fourth show I ever played in my life at age 19.
Well, speaking of which, did you ever get an opportunity to did you ever get an opportunity to share a bill with Motörhead over the years?
Perhaps some festival or other that over the years the lineups have blurred, but never as like direct support. Never
Yeah.
as like direct support. I mean, I suppose it's possible. Like I played Roskilde a couple of times. It's very likely Motörhead was on, you know, at least one of those bills because they're just so ubiquitous on all the European festivals, you know.
Yeah.
But in terms of actually playing and hanging out with them, no. I mean, I hung out with Lemmy a little bit at the Rainbow.
Oh,
You know,
really?
shot the shit with him a bit there at the Rainbow Bar and Grill. Yeah, he's playing his VO poker or whatever he's doing. Whatever game it was, you know, hanging out by the bar.
Did you just kind of like just wander in and there he was?
Yeah. He was a fixture, you know. That's all that you
Yeah.
hear about how he was just always there when it was not a exaggeration. He was just there whenever, if he wasn't on tour, if he was back home in LA, he would be a lot of nights at the Rainbow, a lot of days at the Rainbow.
That must have been a pretty cool thing to do, though. I mean, did you expressly go to the Rainbow thinking, maybe Lemmy will be there?
No, it hadn't even crossed my mind. I of course had heard stories, but we were going there to sort of meet up with a bunch of people. I think I was on tour with somebody. I don't remember. I was on tour, and of course I've gone to the Rainbow every single time I've gone out to like NAMM or whatever. You know, end up going to the Rainbow at some point or the other, but. Yeah, I've seen him there at least a couple of times. Him and a lot of other really interesting luminaries, like Ron Jeremy's always there. He used to always be there.
Wow, right. Okay.
Oh
Now,
yeah.
yeah,
Oh,
that is interesting.
yeah. Yeah, have
Now,
some.
I given your sort of musical journey with Motörhead, did you ever get to see them live? I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, you didn't, you didn't play with them directly.
Absolutely. I absolutely. I've seen them live a handful of times. Yeah, I think I probably saw them on Orgasmatron. I never saw them when I really wanted to back in the 70s. I couldn't get my father to take me. My dad finally took me to a show in 1979, and that was my first concert. I had been wanting to go to shows since probably about 75,
Right.
when I really first started to understand that live shows were a thing. I mean, I was only like 8 years old then, you know? But finally, at about age 11, he bought me tickets. He bought two tickets, one for him to go with me, to chaperone me, basically, and one for me in 1979 to see Kiss
Right.
at the and so I was still a huge Kiss fanatic, you know. I mean, Dynasty wasn't my favorite album by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, it was still the original lineup. They still had never taken off makeup yet, and I was, while I didn't super love Dynasty, I was still very much in love with the first studio albums and the first two live albums. And at least one, you know, I really liked a lot of Ace's solo albums. So I was big into Kiss still at that point. So that was my introduction into going to concerts. So I sort of missed the boat on the era of Motorhead that I really wanted to see. You know, I believe I saw them in Germany in 83, I think the first time, with like Thin Lizzy and a bunch of other people at the Monsters Rock. It was Monsters Rock.
Wow.
So that was incredible.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And another Thin Lizzy adjacent Motorhead story from me that also connects to my time touring with Agent Steel. When we went over to the UK to start kick that tour off at the Hammersmith, we arrived a couple of days early, and we did rehearsal at a London rehearsal facility. I want to say it was called John Henry, perhaps.
You're right. It would have been John Henry's.
Yeah. So we went to John Henry's to rehearse for for this tour, because we were going to be kicking it off at the Hameo in a night or two. And, you know, we were setting up, getting ready to play. Everyone's sort of milling in and out and about. And I walked to this other little area where there was like, I don't know, there's a little place to have a little sit down or whatever. And I think there was like a practice amp sitting on a table in there. I don't know what exactly it was, kind of a lounge or something, or just a little alcove with some chairs and whatnot. And it was sort of dimly lit. I remember it was a lot of neon. There was some neon lighting. I remember that. Or just dim lighting. I may be misremembering. But there was a guy in there, and he was playing on this practice amp. And I walked in, I forget, because there was some beverages to be had in there or something like that, we had been told. So I went in there and I had my guitar. I set my guitar down and I was getting a drink, and I'm looking over at this guy, and I'm like, this fucking guy looks familiar, is pretty familiar to me. You know, this was 1987, mind you. 3 years after, one of my all time favorite Motorhead albums, you know, It was Robbo. And, you know, we shook hands and we talked for a little while. And I don't remember all the details of the conversation. I just remember that I had read somewhere in some magazine that he was a bit of a tool. And he was a perfectly lovely guy to me. A lovely chap.
Oh, that's cool, man. Because you've got a real affection for that album, haven't you?
I do. I do. Stay calm. Don't be alarmed. It's just a holiday. Back at the funny farm.
Yeah, it's weird because it's one that kind of it does divide kind of Motorhead fans.
Yeah, sad curmudgeons who just hate good music, I guess. It's a fantastic album, and I don't see it as such a great departure, but I gather people were just sad about Fast Eddie. You know, about Eddie Clark, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that you know, that same year gave us that Fastway record, I think, which was really pretty damn awesome.
What was it like, so the first time you saw Motorhead, was that Orgasmatron? Or was that in Germany?
I think it was in Germany in '83 was the first time I ever saw Motorhead. But
Right.
you know, that was a massive festival with an absolute shitload of bands.
Yeah.
You know, of which Motorhead and Thin Lizzy, for some reason, are the only ones popping to the forefront of my mind right now. But I do that. I draw a blank and put on the spot quite often to when it comes to old memories anyway. But yeah, that was great. I went to the same concert, Monsters of Rock, the very next year as well, and it was I think it was like AC/DC, Van Halen, Motley Crue, except Gary Moore. It was a lot.
Yeah.
It was
Yeah.
a
So
lot.
what was your first unique Motorhead experience like? Like, you know, as in seeing them in a venue on that Orgasmatron tour?
I don't think I would be able to call my experience unique simply because so many people say the same thing about Motorhead. Fucking loud. And I just
Yeah.
remember going, I had hearing protection because I've always worn hearing protection. I've worn hearing protection my entire career, rehearsal shows, whatever. You know, and even going to concerts as a fan, I've always protected my hearing. And if I forget my earplugs, I'll stuff tissue paper in there. It's not perfect, but at least it cuts down on the high-end frequencies that can literally just take your ears out. So, my ears have remained somewhat sensitive to loud sound over the years. You know,
Yeah.
I haven't succumbed to the, you know, of all the many old man ailments that I've started to succumb to, sharp hearing loss is not one of them, fortunately. The eyes are going, the knee going, you know, the wheels are coming off, but the ears are relatively intact.
That's the main thing.
Yeah. But and I remember, despite having hearing protection in, being uncomfortable in that show,
Yeah.
but I still enjoyed every minute of it. You know, every minute of it, because you're sitting there, you know, you're looking at Lemmy, for fuck's sake, you know. And you know, it was just fantastic. It was a fantastic show. I think I saw them on 1916 as well.
Oh, right. What was that like? De let me guess, loud?
That do they always, you know, their stage show is consistent. You know, Lemmy's like singing into his microphone, you know, and you know, it's got the Rickenbacker, you know, it's just for the people, when you can understand his stage banter, it's classic. Yeah, even when you can't understand his stage banter, that is iconic. You know, a lot of Americans, you know, that the accent is thick, and when you add the gravel of Lemmy's voice and the chaos of loud PA and a loud audience, you know, it's kind of hard to understand what people are saying on stage, even when they have the exact same accent as you. But yeah, it's just an experience. You just want to take it in, even if you can't understand if it's too garbled, you know, because of the loudness and the crowd noise and you know, the accent and the gravelly voice, what he's even saying, just sitting there watching him, his you know, stage band talking to, you know, to the crowd, much less the iconic songs. So you know, I just you know who I was in a band with, probably the biggest Motorhead band that I've ever known. And 30 some odd years ago at this point, 34 years ago, this guy had the biggest Motorhead collection that I've ever known anyone to have. And I imagine 30 years later, especially since he runs a music store in Japan these days, that it must be, if he's maintained that interest, it's got to be one of the most insane Motorhead collections in the world, I would say. And that's Billy Andrews from Death, the drummer that played
Oh.
on Leprosy and Spiritual Healing.
Yeah.
And He was absolute Motorhead madman. So I learned stuff about Motorhead from him that I didn't even know. You know, I don't remember specifically what, but I remember, you know, him telling me things about various releases and things like that. Just details that I know, and details about different pressings, you know.
Oh yeah. Well, that's and that's all part of the era as well, isn't it? You know, that's all part of those well, the whole Motorhead catalog, really. So when obviously as their career progressed, and your career progressed, did you kind of still keep checking in, you know, every time an album comes out? Because I know what it's like as a musician. Sometimes, you know, you kind of lose touch with everything.
I would definitely say that I lost touch for a little bit, probably right up after 1916. I'm probably a little goofy right now about the entire you know the order of things. It seems like Orgasmatron, then just a couple years later, I went to a show on the 1916 tour, and then I lost track. I would say that I didn't keep up with them probably through like I know I never heard March or Die until years later. Yeah, same with Bastard Sacrifice. Yeah, I would say I started getting back into them again on right about Inferno. Yeah, and then man, I think I missed Kiss of Death, but I have Motorizer. I need to give these a listen. There's a handful at least that I've just completely, because I went back and sort of, you know, discovered March or Die and Bastards and Sacrifice. But I don't think I've ever listened to Overnight Sensation, Snake Bite Love, or Hammered. But I did listen to We Are, I do have We Are Motorhead and Inferno. And then I never listened to Kiss of Death. I have Motorizer.
Yeah.
But I think I gave a listen to The World Is Yours, but I've never heard Aftershock or Bad Magic. So I've got some homework to do.
But this is the thing about how consistent they were as well. You know, it was just like album after album, tour after tour. It's why the, you know, the band still lives on today when there's no band, you know. It's kind of crazy. I mean, here we are talking on a podcast that's dedicated to Motorhead. You know, and at this point there hasn't been a band for quite some time. It's all about the fact that, you know, they live on. It's kind of crazy, really.
Yeah, the biggest stretch between records is the 4 year, 3.5, 4 year stretch between Rock and Roll and 1916. Rock and Roll was an album I got into as well, but I didn't see them on that tour. But yeah, it was about a 4 year stretch between Rock and Roll and 1916. But that's the largest that they ever had. There's a couple of 3 year stretches and a
Yeah.
and a bunch of 2 year stretches, and but nothing more than four from 1977 to 2015. That is an insanely cool track record. But I guess I knew, I mean I knew they had, you know, quite a few albums, and that I was familiar with only probably a little more than half of them. And
Yeah.
like I said, you know, I'm a massive Motorhead fan, but it went from probably 1979 when I got Overkill and Bomber, and carried on to, you know, through probably 1916 in 91. So, you know, I stuck with them. You know, I was with them there for almost 15 years straight as just a massive fan. And then, you know, my career was in full swing by then. You know,
Yeah.
I was very, very busy, and because of that, like sort of every band just sort of fell to the wayside for me, and I wasn't listening I as much as a fan anymore. That's just the reality that happens when you get busy and get out on the road, and when you're not on the road, you're in the studio, and when you're not on the studio or the road, you're doing press. et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just the time for, you know, your personal, you know, listening diminishes greatly.
One thing I did want to ask you about, because you were always on, you know, obviously you've been in the heavier side of the industry. Do you think that was informed a little bit by Motorhead? Because as you said earlier, you know, there was other things that were around, but then when Motorhead came along, it was just a completely different beast.
I'm not sure what the question was.
The question is, do you think Motorhead, the kind of impression that it gave you, is that what steered you towards the heavier side of the industry, because that's the kind of, you know, bands that you ended up in?
They were definitely a factor. And I'm sorry, I don't think you worded it badly. I think I was just distracted because I was noodling. I do that a lot, I distract myself.
He's noodling on his guitar playing Motorhead riffs, ladies and gentlemen.
So, but yeah, no, they were definitely one. Like I said, you know, their album, you know, No Sleep Till Hammersmith,
yeah,
put, you know, gave me a goal in my career that, you know, I just looked at as this lofty, unachievable goal, and then I did it inside of, you know, in about 3 years,
yeah.
Like 5 years. Yeah, you know, I don't, I forget how much it was, 6 or 7 years actually. For No Sleep, yeah,
that is pretty incredible. That really is. And the fact that you were able to hang in there, well, that you, like you said, you know, you hung in there as a fan for X amount of time before you literally become too busy, because that, you know, that they were putting out a lot of albums, and threw a complete curveball in there, with Another Perfect Day, or at least a curveball for some people, but you know, you were still able to hang in there as a fan. That's pretty impressive until things really get busy.
Yeah, and dude, I absolutely love that album. It wasn't so much a curveball for me. I mean, I recognized it. To me, I saw it as sort of it seemed like a step up, certainly in like production value. You know.
Yeah.
You know, I can't really say it was a step up musically because the albums prior to that are so iconic to me. Definitely it was not a step backwards, or I guess that people sort of consider it a sidestep, you know, like they stepped off the path for a moment, but, I don't know. I don't really see it that way. I think that album is just incredible. I love that album.
I saw you put a post up saying that, like, look, if you're not a Motorhead fan, fine. But if you're not a fan of this record, then you've got a problem.
I think what I said was, yeah, I'm cool with it, you know, if you're not a Motorhead fan. But if you are a Motorhead fan, but you don't like Another Perfect Day, I just don't think we can be friends anymore. Yeah. Come on. I mean, you know, just for Back at the Funny Farm, Shine, Dancing on Your Grave, One Track Mind. These songs are, dude, they're still playing a lot of these songs decades later, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that says something.
It does, and you know, look, it's been really, look, it's been really cool going through the old Motorhead memories with you, I, like I said, just doing that whole Hammersmith thing so quickly, that's just insane.
Trust me, I was looking. It was literally 6 years after Motorhead was there making that album, six, maybe seven. I think it came out in 81, right? No Sleep Till Hammersmith. And I was there in 87. You can believe that I was roaming that place.
Yeah.
Looking for any signs of Lemmy and the Boys. I was looking for graffiti on the, in the dressing room wall, looking for anything I could find. I did, you know, years later, 30, you know, however many years it is later, 34, 35 years later. I don't, my math may be off on that. But you know, that was 1987.
Did you ever get back there?
Get back to the Hammersmith?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I ever played the Hammersmith again. And I played London a bunch of times after that,
Yeah.
but it was like places like the Marquee and shit like that, you know. Never the Hammersmith again. But I did, you know, I walked past the Hammersmith a couple of times, you know, on later visits, you know, to London, but I never played there again. And I don't remember now, you know, 35 whatever it is years later, whether or not I actually found anything inside. I think there might have been like a post, you know, No Sleep Till Hammersmith poster put up in glass,
Yeah.
somewhere in the hallways in the office areas and whatever, or maybe, but I don't remember finding anything more personal, more cool, like some graffiti and, you know,
Yeah.
made by boys or whatever.
Yeah. Well, look, James, I really appreciate your time. And look, thank you for for sharing your love of Motorhead and your experiences with us. But really do appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Howard. Thanks for getting in touch with me, and I'm happy to chat.
And I was happy to chat too, and hopefully you enjoyed listening to that as much as I did doing it. Yes, I've got to say that, haven't I? Become a bit of a catchphrase. I really enjoy talking to James, and interesting there as well that I know some people will be horrified that James has discovered that there's Motorhead albums he's never heard or realized that. But everybody's journey through fandom is different, and especially when you're a professional touring musician, you do lose track with some of your favorite bands. You dip in, you dip out, and the thing that I take away, though, is that amazing No Sleep Till Hammersmith, and then playing Hammersmith as one of your first ever gigs. That's just insane. Absolutely crazy. And there are many, many stories and many great episodes in the world of the Motorcast. All you need to do is subscribe to find them. There's loads in case you haven't already listened to them all. Tell people, share it with people, let them know that there is a Motorhead podcast out there. All that remains is to thank you all for listening. Really genuinely appreciate your support. Loving doing this, loving speaking to all sorts of people about their love of Motorhead. And, you've all been so kind and so positive about the Motorcast. It really is very, very cool. Can't thank you enough. Thanks for joining in, and I will talk to you again on the next episode of the official Motorhead podcast, The Motorcast.
I don't show you greed. The only card I need is the Ace of Spades. The Ace of Spades.